Folks, the stock market has made yet another all-time high, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, it's been 141 days under my control that the stock market has been. We have the best economy, okay, ladies and gentlemen, probably in the history of the United States. In the history, I don't want to say in the history, but I'm going to say in the history of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QTR podcast.
What's up, fools? How the fuck is everybody? With April showers come Mayflowers, and with all-time stock market highs comes a curmudgeon-y, angry drunk behind a microphone. And here I am, folks, with bells on, smiling from ear to ear, baby, just like he says in Boiler Room. Ferrari, Cabriolet, you think money can't buy happiness? Look at the fucking smile on my face. Ear to ear, baby. All right. First and foremost, this podcast, like all my podcasts, are brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up on Patreon and make a monthly recurring sum. They donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. The podcast doesn't happen without my patrons. I want to acknowledge them. I want to give you two short rules for what's going on today. Then I want to introduce one of my favorite guests. First and foremost, this podcast is brought to you by my friends at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. My homeboy, Sang Lucci, Anand to his friends, Sang to his not-so-close friends. Call him Anand, though, next time you see him. Be like, yo, what up, Anand? Anand and his brother, Charlie Bathgate, have been running the Sang Lucci Steam Room for, shit, probably close to a decade. It is a live chat room that during the day you can monitor to take a look to at... Man, I fucked that up. There goes the fucking Lucci patron right out the door. God damn it. The Steam Room monitors big money coming into the options market. Why is that important? Because a lot of times when big money starts moving around in the relatively illiquid options market, it can telegraph where equities are going to go, and having that information in advance probably is good for business if you're a trader. Not going to say it's a definite, but shit you may want to know about. So Lucci and his boy Charlie Bathgate are experts at that. The Sang Lucci Steam Room is an exceptional value, definitely worth checking out, can pay for itself very, very quickly. And if you're not into that, Lucci also offers his master course in investor education, and he offers something called the 3LT Playbook, which is the three rules that he used to become a seven-figure trader. If you haven't listened to my last podcast with Lucci about blowing up your trading account, it's worth listening to because he discusses some of that in length. But check out his links. They're in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my brother, Pete, over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a no-bullshit trading service that Pete started when he got tired of the nonsense that comes with other trading services like AI. They don't give a fuck about their people that are paying and hanging on as customers. They just care about the proprietor of the trading service making money. So Pete said he's going to start his own thing. They trade in red markets. They trade in green markets. They do investor education. They do daily live streams, daily watch lists. It's a great tool to have in your tool belt if you're a day trader. Right now, Pete's adding a new swing trading service only for busy professionals who don't have time to be sitting in front of a fucking computer all day. This is great. If you want to be a day trader, but you also want to hold down your side job, you're one of those guys that takes like 11 bathroom breaks during the day to go check out your phone and kind of see what's going on with the market. Pete's service, this new service will include all educational videos, the charting college, and their daily swing trade watch list and all swing trading alerts. So members get between 3 and 5 alerts each week on small caps, large caps, and options trades. The new service for busy professionals is on sale now, but it's not going to be for a while. It's just an introductory deal. He's going to give you $100 off his standard pricing. So check out my brother Pete over at The Trader's Path. The link is in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Rumorhound. If you're looking to round out your tool belt of day trader tools, check out rumorhound.ai. The link is in the podcast description. What is Rumorhound? Rumorhound is a service that tracks rumors in mergers and acquisitions, online, in the news, anywhere you can find trading information. And what it does is it uses its proprietary algorithm and identifies proprietary variables to try to determine whether or not the rumors are worth following or worth ignoring. So as you know, when rumors pop up about M&A, a lot of times they can be true, a lot of times they can't be true. They aren't true, rather. When you know the difference, you have a chance to make some money. Rumorhound is a tool that helps you try to identify the ones that have some credibility. So they'll look at the credibility of the companies, they'll look at the financial metrics, and a million other different proprietary variables that you can only get at Rumorhound. It takes that, spits back to you a very easy to read recommendation so that you can, you know, take a swing when the time is right. Maybe make some money instead of losing it all the time, you degenerates. Check out my homeboys over at rumorhound.ai. Awesome service, awesome people. In the podcast description, the link is there, and you can follow them on Twitter also at Rumorhound. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my buddy Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer, Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground, Chris Bede, Ken R. and Chris Boas, my homeboy Crichton Titus, Ken, Mr. J.K. Cunningham, and Stank Love still in the house with my homeboy Brainerd Ferguson, and finally some patrons that have been with me for a while. Kevin Sullivan, what's up, my brother? Wallaby, I still see you. Brian Holloway, what's going on, my kind friend? And Agnes is still with me after a while, which I appreciate. Bertha Moreno, thank you so much for hanging on since October of 2018. Appreciate the shit out of you. My friend Paul T. Breed, a.k.a. Unreasonable Rocket, what's going on? M.H. Sandberg and Fraser McKenzie, thank you so much, guys. Ben S. also, and Shane Mitt, Space Ventures Investors. I see you guys too. Two more rules. We'll get started with the podcast. First, there's a 2-drink minimum. Take 2 to the face. Ask questions later. And finally, this is not investment advice. This is not life advice. I'm not an investment advisor. I'm not a financial advisor. I hold no licenses, no registrations. I don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Ladies and gentlemen, don't follow any advice you hear on this podcast. Do your research elsewhere, fools. With me on the line, the first man to ever come on to the Quote the Raven podcast. Bill, you took a chance on me. I couldn't love you any more than I do. Bill Fleckenstein, he's a money manager. He has over 30 years experience. He's written daily commentary. Check out his website, please. It's FleckensteinCapital.com. And he is also very outspoken on Twitter. I put you on push alerts last week, Bill, so I've been getting notifications to everything that you said. And I love reading your commentary. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So listen, I got a million things I want to ask you about because I haven't talked to you since September. But one thing that kind of just moseyed its way into the discourse today is this tweet from Neil Kashkari, which I was wondering if you saw today. Did you see Mr. Kashkari's tweet that he put out this afternoon?
I saw one earlier. Can you give me a freshened up? Tell me what it was about.
Was this the one where he said
the Fed printing money didn't impact stocks or something like that?
No, equally as stupid. But that's not the one I'm. That's not the one that I'm looking at. He said he was arguing with this guy Sven Henricht. You know him?
I've read his stuff. No, I don't know him.
Okay, so Sven said to him that. Sven was is saying in response to another of Kashkari's tweet, incidentally dismissing critics as QE conspiracy theorists is not only poor form, it's a cop-out for avoiding public accountability and acknowledgement of the side effects and damage of the Fed's ill-conceived policies. And Kashkari responded, "One thing I've learned about Twitter is the louder the critic, generally the thinner the skin. I confess finding amusement in needling critics, calling them conspiracy theorists or gold bugs. It is fun to watch swashbuckling pirates of free market capitalism get really upset. I mean no offense."
Well, you know, the Fed has shown itself to be wildly unaware of what its actions can do. They don't think they had any hand in the stock bubble that ended in early 2000. They didn't think they had any hand in the housing bubble and lack of regulation oversight that they were supposed to pursue after Glass-Steagall had been repealed in 98. So the fact that he is denying that the policies have anything to do with stock prices going up is sort of ridiculous, particularly when Bernanke already bragged ages ago about the portfolio balance channel by which stock prices going up drags the economy along. So So they also are unaware of the fact that asset prices getting too high and misallocated capital causes problems. You know, obviously the two bubbles I just mentioned were examples when they burst of that. And these guys just don't, they understand their policies so little that, you know, they got caught flat-footed in the fall when their intent to hold the funds rate at a certain level, which was below where the market wanted to clear, thanks to the amount of financing the dealer community needed. And so they don't know how their own policies work. They don't know how misallocated capital works. They don't know that high asset prices can be a problem. They're just completely unaware of everything. So I don't find I find his comments, those comments, offensive, but I don't find them surprising because they're completely consistent with the rest of the idiotic things that these guys say and do.
Yeah, I think to some degree, me and you had a discussion probably 3-4 podcasts ago about whether or not the Fed understood what was going on and that they were just hiding it, which is something that I kind of thought, or if they were just dumb and believe their own bullshit, which was, of course, the argument that you made. And this certainly gives your argument some credence, I think.
Yeah.
I have to apologize.
I mean, they just... They don't know. It's okay. I mean, we can disagree, and maybe we don't. But the fact of the matter is, I almost have to laugh. I see people say, "Oh my God, they're doing this. What do they know?" They don't know anything. They don't know how their own policies work. They can't do their job from a regulatory standpoint, which I just discussed. They got caught flat-footed on this IOER. They think they're going to end their repo facility. I doubt that they can, because then the repo rate's going to go screaming up, and their short-term interest rates are going to get out of whack again. So anyway, they aren't these brilliant people that are in charge of any kind of conspiracy-oriented ability to do certain things. They're a bunch of clueless bureaucrats, period.
Yeah, and it's really frightening if you I don't know. I had a moment today when I read this tweet where I started to think, I knew I was going to be speaking to you this afternoon, and I was like, man, maybe Bill is right. And I think to be honest with you, it's even more frightening to just think that these guys are in the left lane doing 100 miles an hour, just breezing past the... I mean, you say that they don't know this, they don't know that. They really don't understand economics. I mean,
They not only don't understand economics, when there's a problem, they have no ability to look at themselves to see if they were part of it. You know, any of your listeners who've traded stocks or made investments has made mistakes. And you have to look to yourself for why did this happen? I mean, the fact that they refuse to do that, yeah, it is rather frightening. It means the whole thing is just going to blow at some point. You know, it's a different problem if they were like super smart and had some conspiracy agenda they wanted to do. That's one kind of a problem, and that's frightening in its own way. But to know that they don't have any understanding of what their policies really do and how they work, and the interrelationship with them and the stock market and misallocated capital, that is actually quite a bit scarier. I would agree with you about that.
Yeah, it's really frightening, and I'm not sure that Kashkari was apparently around during TARP. Somebody had tweeted today.
No, he was. He was there at the beginning, and I actually thought that he kind of understood things for about 5 minutes. And I mean, that's the amazing thing. He was there. He did see what the damage that was done. And I guess he obviously didn't think that the Fed had any hand in the disaster that hit. And he thinks that they had a hand in the recovery. So it's like their policies can only do good, I guess, is what they really think. And anything that bad comes out of it, wasn't a function of what they did. It was the function of the bad people in the market, I guess.
And I think a big problem is, as the stock market, which I'm sure Neil is using as his scorecard just as the president is right now, as the stock market continues to advance to all-time highs for all the wrong reasons, it just emboldens this type of arrogance. Not just with him, not just from, you know, the Fed and anybody else that's setting monetary policy, but investors also too, right?
Yeah. And that's why you get this incredibly lopsided, you know, behavior and, you know, series of sentiment readings. I take one technical service that sent some stuff out today about, you know, sentiment, various sentiment measures are basically the, from a bull to bear standpoint, of the highest in history, and speculative call buying, you know, volume to open on options, you know, as a percentage of total NYSE volume is at the highest in history, highest and most bearish in history. There's all kinds of sentiment stuff that's off the chart. There's all sorts of risk taking going on that we don't necessarily know about. We can guess at. And if this market, if and when the market starts to go down for whatever reason, it finally happens. At some point, it's going to be a horror show. I mean, the question is, what's going to cause it? And, you know, I think every time I've talked to you, I've discussed the fact that, you know, none of us have seen this sort of volume of QE and money printing that we've been going through. And we had a period in time where they were trying to shrink the balance sheet. But the amount of QE, the repo facility that they did, which is just QE, in the fourth quarter was the size of what QE3 was for a year, basically. And in the fourth quarter of 2000, when they were trying to protect us from the Y2K, you know, calendar turn, the liquidity they put in then was about $35 billion, which is about a tenth of what they did this quarter, less than a tenth. And, you know, that gave us a blow off in 2000. So, I mean, as crazy as things are, they could get a lot crazier. I mean, there's just no way to know how crazy it will all get before it finally flames out from exhaustion, or the Fed finally gets discredited, which I think is going to take longer, but who knows?
Yeah, the numbers just keep getting bigger, right? It's like the national debt. You know, what's the difference between 15 and 20 trillion to the average person? Well, people don't know. People can't even fucking conceive what $1 trillion is, you know? So it's just like, right. Yeah, the number just gets a little bit bigger. It's a number on a screen to most people. It's the same thing with this, you know, new QE that's going on. Mom and dad on Main Street don't even understand that this is going on, what's happening. You know, but what was once, $35 billion, it conveniently turns into $350 billion, conveniently turns into a trillion. And like you say, right, what's the blow-off point?
Well, and you have generations. You have a couple generations of investors who've never seen anything but a couple of negative years, and they think this is all normal.
Right.
So unless they read history books, they don't really have any concept of what might happen if this stuff, when it starts to fail or they have to stop for whatever reason, or what they try to do doesn't work for a variety of reasons. But for the moment, as long as it results in higher stock prices, nobody cares very much.
Yeah, and the worst part is even the regulators, even the Fed thinks that everything's fine. And the Fed thinks this is normal, you know, what's happened here over the last 10 years. And that this is how things should be. They made some comment, Jerome Powell made some comment several months ago, I think, after I last talked to you, which is the Fed's job is to keep the economy booming at all costs or something like that. And I was like, what? You know, like, they think that this is it. We should just always be on a steady upward trajectory at all times. And inflation is just going to magically park at 2%. And that we can just, and that's it. Like, we've already found the solution. We just got to get some of the variables right. And once we plug them in, we'll be on this path to eternal prosperity.
Kind of, yep. I mean, that's kind of what the mood is right now. Yep.
So what are you making of the market? What are you doing personally here over these last, let's say, 2 months? I think I last talked to you in September. What's happened since then? You know, this phase one of the trade deal finally wrapped up after a, you know, what felt like a 6 hour long press conference the other day. The market has hit all time highs several times over. You know, Tesla has squozed 300 points probably since the last time I talked to you. Has anything changed with you and your take on the market over the last 3 months? Are you seeing anything different, Bill?
Well, since we spoke was when the, you know, QE4 started, and all that's done is, you know, levitate things. I had a token short in Tesla and Micron. I covered the Micron. I kept a little Tesla because it was so small. And I haven't tried to do anything else because I felt like this liquidity injection, QE facility, repo facility, whatever you want to call it, was going to make it hard for stocks to go down. So I have not done anything on the short side. And my area to invest in precious metals, then they kind of did all right in the fourth quarter, and especially a bunch of the mining names, the ones that I was in particular, did pretty well. And so far this year, metals and miners are kind of they're not doing very well. We've got all this noise, even though the price of gold ran up big on the, taking out the Iranian general. And I thought that was kind of dumb because, I remember when it happened, I thought this could turn out to be actually, a positive development for the world, not a negative one. So seeing gold go crazy kind of made me a bit nervous. I didn't have any trading gold to sell. I mean, I sold it on the way up. But other than that, I haven't really done anything. I mean, I can't own stocks because for the reasons I've already described, and I don't want to be short them. And the metals are a way to make investments and have the fact that the Fed doesn't know what it's doing work for you instead of against you. And the fact of the matter is you can find mining companies that are objectively cheap, especially relative to other things, that have, growing cash flow, dividends, earnings, and things like that, and have other and maybe doing things with their companies that so they're not just dependent on the price of gold. So that's kind of where I've been holed up, so to speak, for some time now, and that hasn't changed and probably not likely to change. I mean, I'd love to get short at some point, but I've been waiting a long time to get short, and obviously not rushing has been a good idea.
Yeah, the Soleimani thing was interesting, right? Because the Dow futures slipped like 440 points at their low that night, and gold futures, the front month gold futures went over 1600, way over 1600. They were up 40 or 50 bucks, and because that was like 7-8 o'clock at night, and then, you know, by the next morning, the market was green again, and gold had given back everything that it had.
To be fair, there was no reason for that spike in gold. I mean,
right.
It turns out that, look, a lot of people like Trump, a lot of people hate Trump, but what you don't see very often is people say, well, on these topics, he's full of shit. But on these topics, or in this instance, he was right.
Right.
So we should give the guy credit. To me, it was a brilliant maneuver. Now, we may get down the road sometime and find out it wasn't, but I thought it was a brilliant maneuver, and he guys should get credit for it. I didn't think there was going to necessarily be the start of huge turmoil, and of course you couldn't know that. So let's be fair about that. But when they came back with their rocket attacks, or basically just, to save face, that was a pretty telling moment that, hey, at least for this 5 minutes, things have de-escalated,
right,
and we won that round. And so after that, the fact that gold sold off, I didn't find terribly surprising because, it ran up. I guess people were worried that the worst was going to happen, and it turned out that it was not even bad. It turned out to be pretty beneficial, I think. So anyway.
Yeah, well, when you're dealing with the Middle East, it's very tough to try to gauge what the hell their reaction is going to be to something
true.
Like this. Because if anybody's going to fly off the handle, go ahead.
We probably haven't heard the last from the Iranians. I don't mean to say that, but, everything's going to be wonderful now. But I'm just saying in the moment, in the near term, the couple of days worth of events back to back were such that you know, the U.S. won a round, and, you know, Trump made a good decision. Now, by the same token, you know, every time he gets on TV, he tells you that this is the greatest economy ever, which is complete nonsense. Yes, the unemployment rate is low, but it's not the, like the quality of jobs are where they were. And if this was a great, the economy was much better in many, many periods than it is right now. So, I mean, you know, it's just complete garbage to say that. But anyway, that is what it is. And they're going to keep saying it, even though it's not true.
Yeah, and despite the price of gold selling off after things kind of de-escalated with Iran, it has held up. I mean, if you look at the last six months, 12 months, it's been good for gold, which is interesting. To me, that's kind of telling the fact that the VIX is so low right now. I mean, the VIX is at a point where it's telling the market that, you know, there's just zero expectation of risk. There's just none. And of course, that's something that the Fed is probably partly, if not wholly, responsible for. But at the same time, Bill, gold has kept a bid.
Yeah, well, I think that that's most likely because around the world, people that aren't part of the G7 central bank clique, so to speak, see the problems and from a monetary and financial standpoint, and are buying gold. And I think one of the reasons why the miners kind of dog it on a regular basis is because more than likely they're bought by, you know, Americans or North Americans in any case. And whereas gold's being bought by the whole world. And so that's one of the reasons why gold's done better, I think, and the miners, even though from a valuation standpoint and you know, financial improvement viewpoint, they're doing quite well. They don't get much love because, you know, the Americans aren't buying gold. The Americans don't see the reasons for it necessarily. I mean, they're making a percent a day in the stock market, and you know, and they're not worried about anything.
Yeah, why would they be when they have Neil Kashkari on Twitter ridiculing people for being long gold? I mean, they literally have one of the Fed board governors ridiculing people for being long gold, for being gold bugs. I mean, that's what this guy is
doing.
Yeah,
well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, the fact that he's a Fed governor, okay, I mean, I guess people think that means he's got credibility, but all you've got to do is look at what they've done, and these people, I mean, that'd be like having the third grader telling me I didn't know anything about investments. Okay, great. I'm glad you think that, but you know, you can't have an argument with an idiot. It's not possible. You can't have an intelligent discussion, I mean, with an idiot. And those guys, they are so self unaware that they are essentially just idiots. Well, and the fact that the guy would do something like that on Twitter just goes to show you how arrogant they are, on top of being, you know, clueless bureaucrats. So, I mean, it is what it is. And you know, when the story of this period is written, you know, down the road, the history won't look kindly on these folks. But you know, that doesn't really matter right now.
Yeah, but the point I was trying to make is, I mean, you know that he's an idiot. I know he's an idiot. But the point I'm trying to make is, you know, I always think about the everyday kind of mom and pop investors and the people that, you know, I've knew growing up, and the people that, you know, I was friendly with, and the people I worked, you know, at a plant with, and the people that I know that are welders, and the people that I know that are iron workers. I mean, and are working, you know, good jobs, but are not involved in finance. You know, what do they see? They see a guy who is on, you know, some type of official board. They probably don't know what the hell the Fed board is, but they see this guy, and he's a former banker, and he wears a nice suit, and he's got a blue check mark next to his name, and, you know, he's followed by the other quote-unquote credible people in the financial industry. And so that's why I think it's irresponsible, because the people that have not taken the time to inform themselves enough.
But it is irresponsible. But you're forgetting that during the housing bubble, both Greenspan and Bernanke, but in particular Greenspan, went out of his way to give speeches as to why real estate could not fundamentally have a bubble because of the nature of the asset class. Now, his logic was wrong, and I kind of tore it apart in the book that I wrote about him and what they did. But they were encouraging people to take on risk and buy houses and all of that, and then the bubble burst, and they didn't get blamed. They didn't get blamed after the stock bubble burst, where a lot of people got shredded, thinking that somebody was paying attention and that no authorities were. And then in this one, where the financial system almost went to zero at the same time that everybody, you know, a lot of people got hurt so badly, there was again no repercussions. So I agree with you that their reckless behavior causes people in it. I don't want to say totally innocent, but people who aren't trying to be greedy. Your buddy, the welder, euphemistically speaking, you know, maybe he has a 401k, maybe set some money aside. He knows he's not a stock market guy, but he knows he should invest, save some money. And he winds up getting hurt. And there's a lot of people like that who don't really, aren't really in the, don't have the training to necessarily kind of be able to ferret out what's BS and what's not. And they get clubbed to death when these things start to unwind. Yes, but they need to come for the Fed with pitchforks one of these days. And, you know, we'll have to see if that happens after this one bursts.
One of the things that I said in a presentation I did a couple of years ago is, you know, while this guy is out there on Twitter spewing this, the Fed has, what, 6,000 tons of gold in a vault somewhere? I mean, there's a reason that the central banks hold gold in reserve, right? So it's like, do as I say, not as I do. Is that what Neil is saying here?
Well, I mean, for the Fed, it's actually not the Fed, it's the Treasury. This is a legacy asset. If you ask most of these bozos if they think it has any value, they'd probably say no. Now, if Judy Sheldon gets elected to the board, she doesn't feel that way. You know, she doesn't seem to be quite as doctrinaire as the way she used to write. Now we'll see what happens if she gets appointed to the board. So I don't think most of the Fed people, they don't give a hoot about gold. They could care less. I mean, and it's only, you know, it's only the Treasury only has it, you know, left over from the old days. It's not anything that they think very highly of, I don't believe. I mean, really, why would you, when you can print up $400 billion in a quarter and splash it in the markets, the Treasury market, to finance the budget deficit, and you could work miracles like that and make the stock market levitate? Why would you think you needed gold when you would think that you're so smart you can push these buttons and do all that stuff? I mean, it's of course they're not going to think much of gold. Do you know what I mean? They almost can't. It's almost axiomatic that they think nothing of it because they're geniuses. Why would you need gold? You have us geniuses running the show. Again, they're not very self-aware.
Right. Would you be surprised if the amount of gold that they are supposed to have in reserve is lower than what was kind of last written about? Would you surprise?
Yeah, I'd be surprised. Yeah, I'd be surprised.
You think they're holding onto it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. I mean, the amount, you got to remember, gold is just a price. Okay. If you and I want to talk, I mean, I see you care about certain stocks. If you want to, let's say you want to talk about Boeing or FedEx or, you know, your MAXR or whatever. If you want to do some research on a company, there's things you can do. You can see about what their new products are, how they're getting received. You can see how their customers are doing. You can do channel checks. You can try to find out different things about what's going on in the business, and you can try to do a lot of research and feel like you get an edge.
Right.
With gold, it's just a price. It's just a price. How do you find out, you know, mine supply, yes, is diminishing, but there's 3,000 tons a year that you know are created, and then there's most all the gold that's ever been found is still in existence. No, I mean, it's not a lot. It's not a huge amount. I can't remember. I think it would fill one or one and a half size Olympic swimming pools. So it's not a lot. I mean, it's a lot of money, but in the paper money world, it's not even that.
Right.
So there is my point is there are not a lot of fundamentals. And so what happens is people see an event and they think the price of gold should go up, and it doesn't go up. It goes down. And so people think, then you start to get this whole line of thinking of, you know, somebody's suppressing it. They always blame the bullion banks. There's a whole body of Twitter sphere that believes in this overt manipulation. I try to explain to these people that I know guys that are not doing this anymore, but you know, who used to work at banks and worked on the bullion desks. One of my best friends was the biggest local in the silver pit in the 90s. And I've met these people for real that are real close to the market. And there is a lot of gamesmanship where they're pushing the price around for their P&L, you know, to make money. We've seen them. They got caught in LIBOR and all that stuff. But what they're not doing is they're not trying to suppress the price of gold for some glorious, you know, bank cabal reason. And that's the conspiracy thing that I think is just, you know, that drives me crazy when I see people give a lot of time and effort to that, you know? So I don't, you know, people think that in order to be able to suppress the price of gold, they got to be able to borrow it. And they hate the fact that there's paper gold. And I get that. But you have to remember, if somebody owns big chunks of this gold, and if you wanted to hedge some of your gold and you didn't want to give it up, you'd want to be able to go sell a futures contract against it. So there's uses for it. And miners, you know, they don't hedge much anymore, but they used to. So are there abuses in the commodities markets? Yes, there's abuses in all sorts of markets. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there's somebody trying to sit on the price. And so the gold's not really in Fort Knox because they did this with it and did that with it, and they used it over here to suppress the price. I just don't believe that. Not because I'm naive, because I looked into it. I did all the digging I could, and I got real close to the source. And I'm completely convinced that no overt price suppression happens. Guys play games all the time, though, for sure. And you can get, you know, beat up pretty good if you get in front of one of those moves, either long or short. So,
why do you think the S&P futures go up at 3:30 almost every day?
You mean like half an hour before the close? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, just staying on this conspiratorial thread that you've introduced. I mean, at almost, you know, 4 out of 5 days of the week, 3 out of 5 days of the week at 3:30, there's a noticeable influx.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe somebody has some idea what sort of their, you know, maybe Vanguard is seeing what their inflows are for tomorrow, and they run out and get, you know, grab a few spoos to get, you know, they're front running their own flows, or not front running, but they're getting, you know, they're buying tomorrow what they need, what they know they're going to need, or some group of things like that. Or then it works often enough and people start to say, hey, look, if you buy at 3:30, and then it's just crowd psychology and it works.
Yeah, but like almost every day at 3:30.
Well, Chris, let me ask you this. When the market opens, what happens?
I don't know. You know, it opens.
It goes up.
The...
It goes up. No,
well,
it goes up.
That's not necessarily true. It opened today. And
well,
it fell.
No, my point is, we're in a mania, and I'm back to using the expression that I used to use in late 1990, late 1999, when somebody would call me and say, "Hey, what's the market doing?" I'd say, "Well, it's open, which means it's up." Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so crazy now. Any combination of crazy things could be going on, you know, but
I don't doubt that we're in a mania. I mean I agree with you there, and I don't doubt that the market's going up, and I don't doubt that it's common for the market to go up in a mania and in a Fed induced bull market. My question is, what the hell is going on 30 minutes before the close every day that there's some fuse that lights?
It could be a whole bunch of things. You know, it could be a whole bunch of different strategies that get flattened out near the end of the day. Some guys do this, that, and they end up doing that. I mean, you don't really think that somebody's – I mean, look, the Fed, we used to – you and I used to discuss the fact that I didn't believe the Fed bought spoos. The Fed doesn't need to buy spoos. They can drop, you know, a nuclear bomb of free money in the markets, and the job gets done for them. So I don't know who does it. I mean, yeah, and maybe three big – guys are work together, try to gun the market a bit. I mean, but again, it's for people's P&L. It's all greed. It's not, you know, let's try to paint something. I mean, it's painting for a P&L standpoint, perhaps, but it's not like, okay, we're going to help the Fed out here. We're going to jam the market up in the last half an hour. I mean, that
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not saying that that's what it is, but I'm saying that to me, it kind of, I don't know. It smells like painting the tape to me because I thought like this was probably 6 years ago, 7 years ago. I started watching the market on a daily, long, long time ago, right when I first like joined Twitter. And I used to notice it then. And then, you know, Ramp Capital came along and there was this joke about, you know, 330 Ramp Capital. And that was like 6 years ago. And I've watched the market pretty much every day since then. So I've had the spoos up on the screen. So it's not like I have a small data set that I'm going by where, oh, you know, maybe you're just catching it on this day, that day, whatever. But I mean, to me, there's definitely something going on. I would love to know what the hell it is.
Oh, but whatever it is, it's small potatoes relative to all the money that they've printed.
Well, I don't doubt that.
And what that does to the market. So, I mean, I don't know. It's an intellectual curiosity, I'll grant you that. But relative to the insanity of QE and more QE and, you know, QE at all-time market highs and all that is, that's the real rocket fuel, if you will, or nitroglycerin or whatever you want to say.
Well, I'll take intellectual curiosity from you. I think that's probably the best that I'm going to get from you. I know I'm not never going to get you to turn to full conspiracy theorist, but at least, you know, you didn't tell me that I'm full of shit. So,
well, you need to understand 30 years ago, I thought the Fed did the kind of things you're talking about. And I dug into it and I got as deep as I could. And I became pretty convinced that they weren't doing that. I don't want to get off on this tangent. We fleshed this out a few other times. So let's just let sleeping dogs lie. Intellectual curiosity and we'll move on.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. And I just want to go on record and say, I'm not suggesting it's the Fed. I'm just saying, like Ilhan Omar said, you know, somebody's doing something.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah. She's brilliant. All right, on to other things. Have you looked at this Boeing disaster that has unfolded here over the last 3-4 months? Do you think the 737 MAX is ever going to fly again? Do you not care at all? Have you looked at Boeing?
Well, you know, it's in my backyard in Seattle. But I haven't paid a lot of attention to it because I know I'm not going to get involved. And, I thought it was pretty shocking the size of the golden parachute they gave what's his nose, the guy who presided over this epic disaster. But no, I don't pay much attention to it. I don't know how it's going to play out. I talked to a buddy of mine who's a pilot, and he said he wouldn't be afraid to fly when he thought they'd sort it out. But that's a very small data set. And I haven't done any research. I don't have an opinion of any use to anyone. So it's just not on my radar screen. I wouldn't be short it. I wouldn't be long it. And so there's nothing for me to do.
Yeah, and I have a friend of a friend. I have a friend who has a friend who is also a pilot who said he thinks it might not fly ever again. So it'd be interesting to watch what the hell happens with this one. Did you catch?
Yeah.
Did you catch any of the last Democratic debate just a couple of days ago here?
Absolutely not.
What do you chance?
I'd watch that.
What's the least of all the evils still in the race for the Democrats? What do you think?
Oh, I think Bloomberg, even though he's not officially in the race, he's the lesser of all evils because he is everybody seems to want to hate on all these guys for some reason or another, and I'm sure, and none of them are perfect. But Bloomberg is a successful businessman, and he ran New York City, and I think he did a pretty good job. Although I know that he did things that some of us would object to, and I know some people, I don't really like his views on every subject, but he's a capable businessman, and he's not completely crazy. And I think one of the things that Trump has shown that even a guy who's not a great businessman, because I don't happen to think Trump is a great businessman, is better for the economy than the world's greatest politician. Because right. I think Obama was one of the great politicians of our time. And I don't think he was a very good steward of the economy. And I think Trump's done a better job, even though I don't think much of Trump. So I think Mike Bloomberg would be – I don't like a lot of his policies, but I like some – a fair bit of them. I think he's the least objectionable of all of them because The problem with the rest is there's just too much free stuff for everybody, almost regardless of which one you talk about. And anyone who believes that kind of stuff or is willing to say that, I want no part of.
Well, it's certainly interesting because when you look at what happened to Howard Schultz, who also is an extraordinarily successful businessman who said he was considering running some months back, who I think is obviously a business world success. He seems like a measured human being, seems like somebody that's got a decent head screwed on his shoulder. And he was turned into a villain by the left just for being a success in the business world.
I know. Chris, I completely agree with you. So it's going to be interesting to see if, you know, exactly. You could take a guy like that who's not objectionable, but if being white and being successful disqualifies you, well, I mean, what I find, you know, it would be funny if it wasn't serious is that we want inclusion, but we only want the inclusion that we want.
Right.
In other words, you can't be white and successful. Nope, that's no good. You know, you gotta fit one of these niches. So the idea that we're supposed to be colorblind to skin or race or all that is the people that talk the most about that sort of thing are guilty of the opposite.
Right.
So the level of hypocrisy in the social media world is and in the the exclusion, inclusion, all that stuff. The level of hypocrisy is just staggering.
That's like reminds me of when Rashida Tlaib went to the Detroit Police Department and she was doing some kind of, you know, press thing, and they had the cameras following her and whatever, and they were showing her some new software, like facial recognition software on people, and she said, "Oh, well, of course you have to have a black person operate this," and the chief of police, who was black, and I think the guy who was sitting at the desk next to her, who was also black, was like, "What are you talking about?" And she's like, "Well, you know, you don't want this to be used disadvantageously against black people." And they're like, "Yeah, but like, you're fucking being racist just by saying that." Like, you know,
right?
There is such a thing as racism against the majority.
Right, right. But you know, the thing of it is there's no consequence to that sort of behavior if you're in the right groups. You know, it's just like. I remember this was quite some time ago, but there was a show called In Living Color, and the Wyand brothers were on it. They were hilarious, hilarious guys. And being black, they could goof on anybody. They could goof on gays. They could goof on other skin colors. They even goofed on handicapped people. They had this skit called Handyman.
Yeah,
now, it's interesting that if you're in a certain demographic or a certain skin color, a certain ethnicity, you can get away with stuff that other ones can't. I've always found that sort of interesting, but that's probably not. I'm not the first person to ever make that observation, but I think that it's sort of interesting, and it's sort of like that. That's the way we are now with identity politics. So,
right.
Which I find completely offensive, but it doesn't matter what I think.
Well, it does. It matters to me, Bill.
Okay.
But this, you know, this incident with Tlaib is, it's a microcosm of what's going on the left. The left has become so far left that they're just chasing their tail at this point. And
well, that's an interesting observation. I think you're correct. And I think if the election was held today, they would lose badly. But on the other hand, what happens if we get a stock market break between now and November and the economy wobbles, which it would, then is it going to get interesting? I mean, this is going to be one of the more interesting elections and consequential, perhaps, in quite some time. I happen to agree with you that I think the left is so busy trying to virtue signal that they don't have any real policies that make sense to most of America.
Well, and the impeachment is a good kind of indicator of that, because they're going through all this procedural muck, and meanwhile, it really looks like even people in their own parties, just based on some of the polling that I've saw over the last couple of months, even people in their own parties are like, you know, what are you guys doing? You know, they're too busy going through this bureaucratic muck to actually try to affect policy. Meanwhile, they've come out and they've supported the new USMCA, right? And some of the Democrats reluctantly, I don't know if you saw, with some disclaimers and some caveats, but reluctantly also said that the killing of Soleimani was a win for the country as well.
Oh, I hadn't seen that. I'm glad to know that. I'm glad to see that some people are willing to be even-handed. I mean, that's good.
Well, I wouldn't say even-handed, because I think most of the compliments I saw were, you know, hey, it's really, really bad.
Well, because the comments that are really offensive are like this idiot Justin Trudeau, you know, blaming our actions against Soleimani for the Iranians shooting down, you know, the Ukrainian plane with so many Canadians on board. I mean, it's a travesty, but to blame Trump for that, I mean, it's just completely intellectually dishonest.
What do you, who would you place the blame on for that Boeing plane coming down?
The Iranians, for Christ's sake.
Well,
who else would you blame?
I don't want to put words in your mouth, you know what I mean? I want to give you a chance to answer. I don't care.
Okay.
And lead with the answer that I want.
But, okay. Well, no, I mean, look, it was the Iranians. Anyway.
Well, that's all right. You know, Trudeau is arguing what? That it's a consequence of they had to fire off rockets to begin with, and the rockets wouldn't have been fired off had the U.S. not, whatever, had the U.S. not killed Soleimani. Is that what they're saying?
Look, for some people, whatever goes wrong is Trump's fault.
That's true.
And so, you know, the fact that the you know, that this occurred, they're using some torture logic because the Iranians shoot first and ask questions later and, oh, are also incompetent when it comes to this sort of stuff, managed to do that. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's not selling well at home for them. So it was a big mistake on their part. They're the ones that did it. You can't blame anybody but them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. I want to ask you just a couple more questions. I know you got a hard stop here in a little bit, but just a couple more things while I have you on. Do you mess with any other commodities, Bill? Do you own oil? Do you own platinum? Do you own anything other than gold in the commodity space?
Well, some silver, but the problem with the PGMs is they're so volatile. You know, you can't have a really big position or a position of any consequence, and you got to know so much about, you know, the how their usage in catalytic converters. I have a friend of mine who trades that stuff for real, and it's just too difficult. I don't like oil because I have to know too much about, you know, the OPEC rig job, and then you've got to know what's going on in with all the you know, all the wells that we found because of fracking, and then you got to have opinion on China, and you got to have opinion on the economy. So it's just generally for me, if I wasn't negative on the overview and the financial backdrop and all that, that'd be different. But when you have a negative view like I do, that's created by these crazy policies and all the risks associated with it, it's kind of hard to want to have something that you think is GDP dependent when, right, if the three card Monte game blows up, GDP is going to get slammed.
Yeah, no. And that's completely understandable. So I just have a couple questions here from some of my listeners, that I'm going to shoot you in, then I'll let you slide. First and foremost, this guy, I don't think this is his real name, Bill, but my patron, Hugh Jasshole, Hugh Jassel. If it is his name, that's very unfortunate. He wants to know what your best gold and silver miner picks, junior and mid, would be now. Do you have any names that stick out at you right now?
Well, I think that as far as silver goes, I think Pan American Silver is hands down the best by a million miles. You know, they made this acquisition of Tahoe Resources. They have a property in Guatemala that's you know, a mine with a mill, and it's ready to go. That's producing 20 million ounces or so a year at, you know, $10-ish cost. And then they got in a flap with the locals, and they handled it poorly, and so Tahoe had it shut down. Pan American's going to endeavor to get it opened up. I mean, maybe they can get that done next year. Well, Pan American produces 28 million ounces a year, 27 million ounces a year. Now you add 20 on that.
Right.
Also, they've got a project in Argentina where they're talking about finally changing the mining laws, and that could get decided in the next 90 days or so. That would and they have the money to build the mine, they'd have to build that one. That would add another 20 or potentially 20 million ounces. So you've got a chance for them to potentially, I don't know if it'll happen, double or triple their production without having to do anything other than, you know, work with the governments and get things done, which is not easy. Don't let me minimize that. But, and then they also have a big deposit they found underneath one of their mines. They've got all these mines, and they've got some of the gold properties that they got in the acquisition. So they're doing everything right, and they're on a roll. And in full disclosure, I was the lead director there for about 15 years. I resigned from the board in about 2011 or so. So that's my easily hands down my favorite silver producer. When it comes to gold, you know, they're all a little bit different. I would say of the big caps, the two best are Agnico Eagle and Kirkland Lake. Kirkland Lake's been in the penalty box because they're making this Detour acquisition. I was initially against it. But you know, they're going to do it, and it's going to be a different company going forward. But I think those two are in the big cap arena, particularly, are probably the two best hands down. I would say AEM is quite a bit more expensive than Kirkland Lake, but they've done everything right. So, anyway, those would be my two favorite gold stocks and my favorite silver stock. I have a bunch of little ones that I own, but they're all kind of different, and you know, you got to kind of get in there and do your own homework. And so,
do you buy like the GDXJ or anything like that? Do you own that?
No, there's too much garbage in it. there's too much garbage in GDX and GDXJ. I mean, there's so many of these companies that are either have bad properties, or they're run by bad, or people that aren't very incompetent, or aren't very competent, or they're in bad locations. And I just as soon avoid that stuff.
Have you looked at all? I have another listener wants to know if you've looked at all into the auto industry and the long or short term effects of how delinquency rates are still rising in the auto industry. I mean, the auto industry is in a global recession right now, right, Bill?
Yeah. But I mean, again, there's no percentage in getting yourself up to speed on problems, because they're not really actionable, because it's too easy to lose with the QE that's going on.
Right.
Means, you know, I mean, you know, the autos generically are in a huge problem, and yet you have Tesla going up at warp speed because who knows why. So, I mean, I just I don't see any advantage to getting up to speed on problems, because you can't make money acting on it.
Yeah, and the game's rigged. You know, you have countries like China that when the auto market starts to recess, the government jumps in, and Beijing wants to offer subsidies, and they want to do things to stoke, you know, sales at local dealerships. And so to some degree, it's very difficult to kind of put a lens on these things when so much is being manipulated from the outside, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, well, finally, my last question. Do you ever take a look at the UK and UK stocks relative to the US? I have a listener that wants to know, like, given the Brexit and the political mess, you know, kind of hopefully being over with now, somewhat over with, it wants to know if that, you know, maybe would make it a good time to start looking at stocks in the UK, equities in the UK. What do you think?
I think probably that's correct. I mean, guys that are smarter than I am are bullish on the pound, not the least of which is Stan Druckenmiller, based on the last interview I saw with him. And then I have another friend who lives in London, and he has talked about the fact that that there's a lot of pretty cheap stocks there for reasons we could guess at. You know, all the stuff that's gone on, they've gotten cheap. So I suspect that's probably a pretty good pond to fish in if you're inclined to want to do that anyway. I think it makes sense. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be some big winners that come out of that.
I haven't even looked at how the UK has done over the last year relative to the US. Do you know off the top of your head?
No, not really, because again, it's not something I intend to do. I mean, I've thought about it intellectually that I think it makes sense to do that, but again, I don't want to be involved in that. I mean, we're so deep into this crazy period then I don't want to have to, you know, get all bulled up on a few things like that and then have to worry about how they're going to do if the shit hits the fan over here and all that other stuff. So I'm just saying I'm going to pass. I don't think it's worth the effort for me.
All right, Bill, listen, man, hopefully in another 3 months, I know you got a hard stop today. We got our times mixed up and I apologize for that.
No, it's my fault.
Hopefully in another couple months, come back on. And I'd love to do something a little bit more long form because I got a million questions here for you. And I love picking your brain. But I want to thank you for taking some time for me today. And on behalf of my listeners, thank you very much.
Okay, Chris, thanks a lot.
All right, speak to you next time. That was the one, the only Mr. Bill Fleckenstein. As in the Bill Fleckenstein that was on podcast one of the Quote the Raven podcast. My original guest. And he hasn't gotten tired of me yet. Isn't that fucking wonderful? I think that's lovely. Great to have Bill on, even though I think he thinks I'm arguing with him a lot of times when I'm not. I'm just trying to have a conversation with him. But I love him. He's just a wonderful guy to talk to, and he obviously understands many things going on in the world of finance that central bankers wouldn't understand if they lived to be 150. And so his opinion is always welcome here. But for right now, ladies and gentlemen, it's 4:45 in the afternoon. It is Friday, and sincerely, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Peace!